Welcome to Dream Jobs Are Us, finding your child's passion and purpose in life. The only podcast that teaches you how to use actual occupational therapy principles, research, and methods to lead your child down the path to finding their direction and landing their dream job. I want to show you how to help your child get what they want out of life. Hi, I'm Chelsea Whitaker, a registered and licensed occupational therapist. I help parents motivate and empower their children to find jobs they love and excel in. One-on-one therapy and counseling can be expensive. I teach parents what they can do from home to get their kids off their couch and into a job they love. You are the most qualified person to guide your child on this journey to find their passion, their purpose, and their direction in life, even if it doesn't feel like it. I've developed a set of tools and strategies that help guide parents with children of all abilities to identify their dream job, land that job, and stay motivated to keep it. Together, we can help make your child's dream come true and set them up for success. Hi everyone, this is Chelsea Whitaker, and I'm here with my sister, Nicole. Today, we're talking about a parenting hack. How your child's sensory preference determines where they'll be most successful. And I'm talking about sensory preference based on Dunn's model of sensory processing that we use in the occupational therapy world. And we use this to identify how individuals relate to their environment with all their five senses and how they process those senses and how it determines their behavior. And although this is created for people with autism, I find it relates to everyone of all different ages. In fact, it has helped me be more successful in knowing where I'm going to be most, what environment I'm going to be most comfortable in. And it relates to you as a parent, because knowing your child's sensory preference is going to help you set them up for success in the job environment that works best for them. So we're going to talk about four different sensory preferences: sensory seeking, sensory sensitive, sensory avoidant, and low registration.
So Chelsea, this is like a really technical occupational therapy thing, but I get it because you go around behind me making fun of me, kind of saying sensory seeking, because you recognize that I'm sensory seeking and I need lots of noise, lots of things to look at, and that's just how I work best. And so if I'm in a room where, like, it's totally quiet, I'm going to start talking or I'm going to start singing because I need to fill up that room with noise because I can't handle being in a place that's totally quiet. And so, like, auditory sensory input, that's just one type of sensory input. So before you describe each of the four sensory styles and preferences, so parents can see which applies to their child, tell me about what sensory input is for each of the five senses. So auditory, like I said, music, noises, having TV on in the background, people having background conversations. It can be as simple as like the humming of an air conditioning system, or the humming of lights, tapping on a computer, tapping on a keyboard.
Right, and what you see, the brightness of colors, the number of objects you have to process. Like if you're driving, you have to process all the signs, the road signs, the smells. Wherever you go, if you go to a restaurant, there's going to be some strong smells there. But if you go to a block where there are several restaurants, there's going to be a lot more restaurant smells to process at one time.
What about taste?
So if you really like to add a lot of spices to your food, or if you find that food is bland without like a lot of salt, a lot of pepper, you would be more sensory seeking. But somebody who just can't handle the texture of certain foods like applesauce or cottage cheese, they'll be sensory avoidant.
And what about touch, the sense of touch? What kind of sensory input would you be talking about there?
So if you're really seeking out things such like while you work, you like to use a spinner sometimes, or play with
like a fidget spinner.
Like a fidget spinner, yes. You're always seeking out that input. You like, as soon as you see a piece of clothing to buy, you have to touch it and feel it. And someone else might, they get really disgusted if they touch something. They would prefer not to touch it.
Okay. So, what describes sensory seeking to me? What does it mean if you are sensory seeking like me?
So you're always looking and seeking more senses. You're always going after more. You work best in an environment that is loud and stimulating. There's more people around, more things to touch, more things to look at. You work best in that environment. Now, I'm more sensory sensitive. So we actually created a little room for myself. Remember when we were in high school? Because you're so sensory seeking, you're loud and you know, kind of obnoxious, especially if I'm trying to do something where it takes a lot of thought work. So we created a room where I could go and be alone and get, you know, my homework done in a less loud, less sensory seeking environment.
That's so funny. I think that's a really good example of the difference between sensory seeking and sensory sensitive. So me being sensory seeking in middle school and high school, I always wanted to do my homework with the TV on. Mm-hmm. And I think it drove everyone crazy, especially my mom. She couldn't understand how I was getting work done with the TV on.
Right.
And she was like, surely you're just watching TV, right? Yeah. Turn it off and do your homework. But the reality was that I needed that TV on as the background noise,
right?
Because I need all that sensory input to have that background noise actually helped me focus on my homework.
Right.
Whereas you had your hobbit hole. That's mm-hmm. what we called your bedroom. And, you know, it was upstairs in the corner of the house. And while everyone was, you know, in the family room on the first floor, making noise and talking and laughing, you had your own space that you could retreat
right.
to that was quiet. You were in charge of that space. You designed it, and it was just the way you wanted it. And that's where you worked best because right. you're sensory sensitive. You're sensitive to all the noises, all the lights, everything else that's
right.
going on around you.
I'm continually detecting all that sensory input, and I have a heightened awareness of it. Whereas you are actively seeking more sensory input to add to tasks, and you like to be busy. Now, somebody who is sensory avoidant actively avoids and withdraws from too much sensory input. They really can't handle it, so they really try to leave the area. And they like order and routine and to know what to expect when the smell's going to be a certain way. They know they might not be able to handle going into a restaurant that has a strong odor, like, you know, like curry and spices like that.
Yeah.
And then someone who has low registration is actually kind of interesting because they seem to miss sensory information. They appear to be really easygoing, but like if there's a fire alarm going, it would really shock my system being sensory sensitive, but it might take them longer to notice that, oh, there's this thing blaring that I need to get up and detect that and move and get it.
That's someone's low registration.
Yes.
So would you find that people that are sensory avoidant and low registration typically on the autism spectrum or not necessarily?
In my experience, yes. They are usually my clients who have autism because even though we can be sensory avoidant or low registration, it really impacts their functionality. So they're not able to function and do things without altering the environment to match what their sensory preference is.
Okay. So let's talk about each of these sensory preferences. Sensory seeking, sensory sensitive, sensory avoidant, and low registration. And give me examples of what the ideal workplace would look like for someone with each of these preferences. So for me, sensory seeking, what would my ideal workplace look like?
So you do best working with other people and having conversations, having bright lights, activity, having the freedom to put music on while you work and really adding any kind of sensory input. Like even if you had a desk job, you could still bring that fidget spinner in with you and be able to play with that. Like right now we're talking and you are spinning a chapstick in your hands.
Chapstick, yeah.
Yep.
So, I'll put that down and pay attention. So, and it's not that I'm not paying attention. It's just that I like to have something in my hands. I don't know. I'm sensory seeking.
And some of my clients with autism, they do best riding horses because their sensory seeking and the movement of the horse while they're riding allows them to organize their thoughts and participate to the best of their ability during the therapy session.
That is so interesting. That's like me in the having the TV on in the background when I'm doing my homework, right? Having that background noise, even though you'd think it doesn't make sense because it's more sensory input, it actually helps your brain organize everything that's going on, right? Because there's something going on in the background. What about you, Chelsea? Someone who is sensory sensitive, not necessarily sensory avoidant. You're sensitive to all that sensory input, but you don't have to like escape from it. You can handle it, but you certainly don't prefer it. What would your ideal workplace look like?
A more business environment where like you have a traditional cubicle where it's not, you know, a lot of noise and you can stay focused on the task. There's not a lot of people going in and out, or like something outside. I work outside a lot where, you know, there's not a lot of excess noise. It's a really calming environment.
Not a lot of distractions. Somewhere where you can work independently. If you have to, where there's not a ton of other people like bouncing around you. What about sensory avoidant? What would the ideal workplace look like for someone who is sensory avoidant?
So this person really does well with a routine and to have control over their environment. This person might do best working at home where they can control where they are, what the environment is, maybe as a transcriptionist or a social media specialist. Something where they're working online in their own office, they can wear what they're comfortable in, and there's not a lot of external structure, like you have to work here and get this done.
What about low registration? If someone falls into that category of low registration, what does their ideal workplace look like?
Well, that person has trouble, responding to input. It takes them longer to respond. So there again, they would do best if they really had their own structured environment where they're most comfortable and they know what's expected of them and they can do what they do with the best of their ability.
So that might be like working from home, maybe?
Right.
Or working in a really structured environment, especially where people understand like that's their sensory preference.
That's right.
I know you've told me that it can be even dangerous for people that are of low registration because they don't process all of that sensory input, important things like that fire alarm going off.
Right.
It doesn't automatically register to them because they just don't process that sensory input at the same level most people do. So they might miss that fire alarm, or they even, they have a high pain tolerance.
Yeah, sometimes because even if someone comes up and touches their arm, like they don't respond to that right away. Whereas so if you come up and someone who is sensory avoidant to touch and you come over and touch their arm, they're going to pull away. Like that's going to be, they're going to really actively avoid that sensation. Someone with low registration might not even like register that you're touching them. Or if someone else walked into the door, that they might not register that like right away.
I can also see it being a safety issue if they're working in a kitchen.
Yeah.
With like knives, right? And maybe they're not as sensitive to like touch. And so if they're chopping something, they might hurt themselves and not even realize it.
Right.
Or they might touch a stove that's on and get really hurt before they register and realize that they're touching a hot stove.
Right. And one other sense we talk about in the occupational therapy world is proprioception, which is knowing where your body is in space. And you might see, we see it a lot. Now, everyone does this. Everyone does these stimming behaviors. If you've ever tapped your foot that's stimming, but someone with autism who is sensory seeking, they might really move around and rock their body a lot because they don't know necessarily where their body is in space.
What does stimming stand for?
Well, that could be, it's like if you've ever seen someone move their body repetitively, you know, it's like, and you just kind of do it automatically without thinking.
Okay. And I think that, so it stands for self-stimulatory behavior. So that's the STIM, self-stimulatory behavior. So stimming, like, you're right, like that's me playing with this chapstick here. I'm just popping the cap off, putting it back on. But you could be like tapping a pencil, tapping your foot, like anything that you're doing, I guess that makes you feel aware of your own body.
Right.
That's that stimming, that self-stimulatory behavior, repetitive or unusual body movement or noises. So yeah, it's probably super apparent for people on the autism spectrum that they're doing it. But everybody does this in some form or another.
Right. And not everyone with autism would do it, but somebody who has that sensory seeking preference related to the proprioception where their body is in space, related to that sense, they would need a job that they could be active and move, and, you know, that behavior wouldn't be seen and be really judged. You know, someone would really have to understand why they're doing what they're doing, and like being able to be active and move around is going to help them focus and do their job to the best of their ability.
Right. And I know that as an occupational therapy, as an occupational therapist, you get even more particular with your clients and determine where they are on the sensory preference scale for each of their five senses.
Right.
So you might find for your client that they're sensory seeking as to taste, but sensory avoidant as to touch, right? And you go through each of these preferences for each of the senses.
Mm-hmm.
But today we're just talking about in general. And I think that you would average that out, right?
Right.
To determine that somebody is sensory sensitive, right? If they're sensory seeking in some areas, sensory avoidant in other areas, like the average is sensory sensitive. It's kind of in the middle of those two. Parents, hopefully from this episode, they'll be able to recognize where their child is on the scale and use this information to visualize what type of workplace would work best for their child, whether it's something that's outdoors or something that's in an office, whether it's a big office with lots of people or an office where, like you said, that has cubicles where people kind of have their own space and it's a little more quiet. Or is it appropriate for your child to be working in a factory with lots of different noises, but they can still be moving around? Or does it make sense for them to work at home, right? Especially for someone who might be sensory avoidant or low registration. In your own home, you have the most control over your environment, what's there, what's not there, what works best for your child. So this was a good insight, I think, into some of the things that we talk about in your online course, The Parent's Guide to Discovering Your Child's Dream Job. We talk about each of these preferences, and you give examples of what types of jobs and workplace work best for people that find themselves in each of these four sensory preferences. So if this information has resonated with you, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Dream Jobs R Us. If you're really getting something out of this, you can subscribe to our podcast. Please consider giving us a 5-star rating or writing us a review so we can, so even more parents can find us. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time. Hey, this is Nicole. If this episode spoke to you, then you need to check out Chelsea's online course, The Parent's Guide to Discovering Your Child's Dream Job. That's because it will walk you through exactly how to apply this life-changing information to your son or daughter.
You can complete the lessons on demand at your own pace. She's thought of and included literally everything you need to put this together for your child. If you've ever thought, well, I don't know how to get started, or I don't know exactly how I can do this with my kid, or what order I should do it in, the online self-coaching course teaches you all of that. Even if you're familiar with these concepts, the Parent's Guide will help you take this work even deeper. And as a bonus, it comes with an exclusive invitation to our private Facebook group, The Dream Team by Chelsea Whitaker, OTRL. OTRL is the abbreviation for Registered Licensed Occupational Therapist, kind of like MD for a doctor and JD for a lawyer. So you might hear us throw it around every once in a while. When you become a part of the Dream Team, you'll have access to an online community where you can connect with other parents with the same goals as you who are working through the same obstacles. Together, we brainstorm ideas and troubleshoot issues, or just lend an ear to listen. You'll also have access to expert coaches like me and Chelsea, and no question is off limits. You can change your child's life today by going to chelsea-whitaker.com. That's Chelsea, C-H-E-L-S-E-A, hyphen Whitaker, W-H-I-T-A-K-E-R.com. Or you can catch us on our public Facebook page, Chelsea Whitaker, O-T-R-L. See you there.